Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis. It's the 17th of January 2014, and today's interview is with Nicholas Crafts, Professor of Economics and Economic History at the University of Warwick. We discuss Professor Crafts' recent work on the very threatening issue of public debt in the Eurozone. I began the interview by asking Nick to provide an overview of his recent Vox column that examined the legacy and policy implications of public debt that has arisen as a consequence of the Eurozone crisis, and why the challenges now are different from those faced in the 1930s.
The paper looks in particular, I think, at debt problems in the Eurozone. And it also, I suppose, wants to shock the reader by saying we think the 1930s was a terrible time. In some ways, later on in the 1930s, countries seem to have been better placed than some of the Eurozone is today. And one very obvious feature of the different situations is that, on the whole, public debt to GDP ratios were quite low in the 1930s. It was also possible, of course, in those days to leave the exchange rate system, and many countries prospered in the later 1930s, having devalued, left the gold standard, and found that the policy freedoms that they got were conducive to quite rapid recovery. So on the whole, debt problems were quite moderate in the late 30s compared with today. Looking at countries in the Eurozone, probably it's fair to say that we've got past the point at which we expect the Eurozone to collapse. I think we see the typical Southern European member in it for the long term. And some people, I think, are sort of thinking to themselves, well, the crisis is over. I think my paper is saying the legacy of the crisis is quite unpleasant. And the legacy, the story can be crystallised, I think, around the public debt to GDP ratio. We've got quite a lot of examples now which are 100% of GDP, more than 100% of GDP. We've got people like the OECD saying, if you wish to stick to the Maastricht criteria as restated in the new fiscal compact, then you've got to get back to 60% ratio of debt to GDP. That is a long period of fiscal consolidation if you do this the orthodox way. So we might be looking at a country like Greece or Portugal having to run a primary budget surplus 6, 7, 8, 9% of GDP for something like 10 to 15 years to match these criteria. That is well beyond what's been achieved typically in democracies in any sort of recent economic history. When you see big debt to GDP ratios in the past, usually they involve some element of default or some element of financial repression or some element of debt forgiveness or something of the sort. It isn't usually entirely achieved by fiscal means. The IMF's recent study of past debt reductions says that for the size that these countries are going to have to do, according to these rules, in the past typically less than half came through this orthodox fiscal consolidation route. So I would see this as potentially a painful process. Its pain might be prolonged deflation and the political responses that that gives rise to, or it might be a disorderly default at some stage, or it might be derogations from European rules which allow much less financial integration, in effect allow capital controls to be imposed much more widely, and then allow financial repression, that is to say, make it much easier for governments to borrow at below market rates, make the fiscal arithmetic much less tight. But it seems to me the prospectus as laid out by these European agreements is barely credible that it will be fulfilled. But the attempt to do so means the future looks rather less rosy for countries engaged in this exercise than for their predecessors 80 years ago.
So you conclude that column by saying that the implicit fault line in the Eurozone is clearly been shown. A year ago, we were talking about potential exit of Greece leaving the Eurozone and perhaps a two-tier euro. You don't see that happening now?
No, I think it's unlikely that the Eurozone is going to collapse, but I do think it likely that southern Europeans will be increasingly dissatisfied with the institutional settlement that comprises the current EU or Eurozone. And even if their leaders aren't, I think their populations will be worried. So the fault line that I had in mind, or the way that I think I brought things together in that piece, was to say that actually if you are one of the heavily indebted southern European economies, you might actually think that European institutions are designed too much in favour of the creditors, too little in favour of the debtors. And in particular, that might be true of the role that the European Central Bank plays. So the fault line, as I put it in the paper, was to say that countries like Greece and Portugal, actually in their own interests, might prefer a different design for the ECB than the orthodox German one, which we have now.
And what might they want to be different?
Well, they first of all might want the ECB to pursue higher rates of inflation. Higher rates of inflation, I think we know, would make their adjustment problems of competitiveness a bit easier. They'd certainly make the fiscal arithmetic less troublesome in terms of paying down these debt ratios. The very last thing a country like Greece needs is deflation, and there are dangers in the present arrangements that we're verging on deflation in the near future. So they might have an interest in a different inflationary mandate for the ECB. They might also see the ECB as potentially helpful as an institution which could, over the long run, aid financial repression by subverting monetary policy to the fiscal needs of governments in the Eurozone. That essentially means keeping interest rates lower for much longer than simple inflation targeting would probably have you do. So those two things in a way go together. And then the third, rather more radical thing, is following a suggestion by Charles Viplosh a few months ago, the ECB is probably the one agent which could in principle relatively easily help in some kind of quasi-debt relief. So the ECB is an agency which could in principle purchase lots of this sovereign debt and offer, for example, perpetual interest-free loans as quid pro quo.
Which is effectively monetizing the debt.
Monetizing the debt, though, might be seen as quite helpful by, at the very least, populist politicians in southern Europe. So, I mean, those are different stages. Any one of them would probably be more helpful to indebted southern European countries than the present set of arrangements. But equally, it seems to me that any one of them would be anathema to Germany. It's extremely unlikely to happen, and hence my notion of the fault line.
So the paper was actually based on an earlier paper you did for Cage Chatham House. Could you describe that a little?
That paper goes a little bit further in thinking about what has been achieved in saving the euro. Points that I think are additional in that paper are, first of all, that there clearly hasn't yet been a successful redesign of the flawed institutions with which we started. The most successful redesign, I think, potentially would look rather like a United States of Europe. It would look rather like a federal Europe in a very full sense. That would have to comprise, it seems to me, a banking union, a fiscal union, and some serious federal level democracy to address what otherwise would be a pretty daunting democratic deficit.
Can you really see that happening?
No, I can't. And the paper says that it's most unlikely that that can fully be achieved. And one simple way of thinking of that is European voters, European populations are too heterogeneous, I suspect, for that to be a feasible agreement, at least among a Eurozone of 17 or 18 as it now is members. So I don't think that route is feasible.
So perhaps then the question is whether you could impose as an alternative some sort of new set of rules that would remove the danger of a new euro crisis.
I'm not sure we can do that either. I think populations will resist that. I do think the minimum reform that you need is a full banking union, fully to eliminate the so-called doom loop, the feedback effects between sovereign debts and bank balance sheets, which are such a fundamental reason for wanting a banking union. But banking union implies not just a supervisory mechanism, you've got to have an effective resolution mechanism with teeth, and you've got to have a fiscal backstop. The implication is a full banking union requires considerably more concessions of sovereignty than I think are on the cards easily at the moment. And the sort of agreement we're going to get will be at most a halfway house.
Yes.
So in saving the union, saved for the moment, but at the same time, the exposure to a future crisis has by no means been completely eliminated. I think the other thing that I was trying to suggest in the longer paper is that this kind of trap, if you like, in which the countries in difficulties within the Eurozone find themselves is not really in the long term conducive to structural reform. It's not conducive particularly to really good supply side policies. And I think the implication is that the creeping disintegration of the Eurozone combined with disinclination to make these reforms implies that coming out of the crisis, leaving aside any issues of high debt, in addition to that, I suspect the change in policies will, if anything, be unfavourable to growth, so that the legacy will be a less good set of supply-side policies and a somewhat lower growth rate than you might have had without the crisis. That, I think, goes further than the conventional wisdom at the moment. The conventional wisdom is the financial crisis has had a permanent effect on the level of GDP in the badly affected countries, but maybe no effect on the trend growth rate. I think what I'm flagging up is the possibility of an adverse effect on the trend growth rate as well.
Nicholas Crafts, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.